Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have Phil Japixi, who is an Agile Practices Evangelist for Telerik. Did I get that right?
You did.
It's very impressive when I get it right.
Yeah. How are you, Jesse?
I am fine. How are you, Phil?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm glad to have you here. So tell me about the state of Agile practices these days.
Well, so Agile's growing, right? So it's, I don't know if I would call it mainstream yet, but certainly it is not just an edge case. What we're finding is a lot of companies are trying Agile, some better than others, but it's you know, more and more enterprises, you know, the bigger companies, not just the small startups and things like that, are really looking at Agile as to how they can cut waste and increase productivity. So it's been a good movement. You know, we're seeing a lot of traction out there.
And you talk about, you present on Agile quite a bit.
I do. Matter of fact, well, it'll have already happened by the time this gets published, but we're sitting in Boston right now. I fly out today for Louisville, where I'm doing a whole day Agile pre-con for Codapalooza. So I'm getting more and more people wanting me to talk about Agile.
And when you talk about Agile for a whole day, what kinds of things do you cover?
Well, so Agile's really, really a big topic, right? And you know, I don't know if, have you done any Agile podcasts before?
A little bit.
So, you know, the whole point of Agile, and should we talk about the Agile Manifesto?
Let me start there.
So a little over 10 years ago, several guys, I think there's 36 of them, went on a ski trip, and at the end of it came out with the Agile Manifesto. So it's a kind of work retreat I'd like to do someday. But they came up with this very short and concise statement, right? And they called it a manifesto. Whether that's the right word or not doesn't matter. And what the beauty of it is, it's brevity, right? So Blaise Pascal once said, I apologize for the length of his letter. I didn't have time to make it shorter, right? And it's very, very concise. So, you know, they start off by talking about, you know, we want to find, well, I've got it right here. So I'm just going to read it.
Okay.
And it's, we are uncovering better ways of developing software by doing it and helping others do it. Through this work, we've come to value, and then we have four value propositions. So it's individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, and responding to change over following a plan. Now, I think those are absolutely excellent points, right? But the most important part that I always try and stress in the Agile Manifesto is the third paragraph or the third sentence. And that reads, that is, while there is value in the items on the right, and those are processes and tools, comprehensive documentation, the contract negotiation, and following a plan, we value the items on the left more. So what we are trying to do with Agile is put the emphasis on things like working with others, collaboration, right? Getting software out the door and shipped. The reason I stress that third sentence is so many times I talk to a company and they're like, and I used to, before I came to Telerik, I was doing a lot of Agile coaching and Agile transformations and training out in some very large companies. And I'd hear things like, we can't go Agile because we need documentation. Or we can't do Agile because Agile means no architecture. And things like that. And that's some of the Agile myths that you hear. And I'm actually planning on doing a blog post series on the Agile myths pretty soon. But I want to stress that nowhere in the manifesto do they say stop doing documentation. Nowhere does it say you can't have a contract, right? Nowhere does it say you can't have a plan. It's just that we've spent 30, 40 years in this industry getting to the point of where the plan was more important than the people. The documentation was more important than having working software, right? You know, a lot of times I'll ask people in my training sessions, I'm like, how many of you are professional document writers? And more often than not, nobody raises their hand. And then I'm like, how many of you feel like you're professional document writers? And almost everybody raises their hand, right? Because it seems like we spend so much time on anything but software that it's amazing we delivered anything, right? And, you know, the other facet of that is this rapid feedback loop or collaboration, right? So if you think of, so I'm a Cub Scout master in my spare time, and we always do a game with the incoming Cub Scouts called the telephone game, and your listeners probably have heard of it, where you say some phrase to somebody in line, and they turn and repeat the phrase to the next person, and the next person, the next person. You go all the way down the line, and you get the whole pack lined up, and there's like 45 kids in my pack. And you say something very simple, like the quick brown fox jumped over a log. And by the time they get through all the Cub Scouts, what comes out the other end is Mary Had a Little Lamb, right? Because it's, we're trying to do it from memory. Everybody has their own context and things like that. And that's the problem that we have if we don't have collaboration, right? We have somebody who has an idea, and they go to take that idea to whoever, some stakeholder, somebody who can enable it. And that stakeholder says, yeah, we should make that piece of software. You know, I want a mobile app so we can increase revenue. Or better yet, I want a mobile app so I can be more effective as a field salesperson, right? And management says, that's a great idea, right? And so they go to a business analyst and say, find out the requirements. And the business analyst would write down the requirements to the best of their ability. I'm not knocking BAs. They have a hard job. And then they would take that document, hand it off to some sort of architect who would then make some sort of architectural specification. And then that would go to a dev lead who then would make some sort of other specification. And then four or five people down the line, a developer gets a word, and instead of developing the quick brown fox, he's developing Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Yes.
Right? And what we're finding, and that's probably the biggest value proposition that companies get, is just the communication. Right. If I enable my developers to talk to what we call the product owner now, right? It's the same thing as business analysts. It's just every time, you know, we have to change names so we can sell more books. You know how it is. So if we enable the developer to talk to the person who had the idea, or at least who wrote the requirements, and say, I don't quite understand this requirement. I see the words, but I don't get the spirit. Can you help me? Well, then we write the right software first. And we don't have to go through this, oh, well, yeah, it compiles and we shipped it and it doesn't work. And, you know, the old adage, not to knock your old employer, Jesse, but, you know, we used to always say you never install anything from Microsoft until version 3, right? And that was because, you know, back in the day, Microsoft has really changed and they're getting it right on the first time now. So don't take this as a thing on Microsoft. It was just an example. But if we can get the software correct the first time, we might not ever have to write a version 2, saving companies tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, sometimes even millions of dollars because we got it right the first time. And we get it right the first time because people are communicating. Does that make sense?
It makes very good sense and speaks to not only some of the basic premises, but some of the basic myths that you do hear about agile programming. What would you say is the smallest group of developers who can effectively use the agile principles?
So I've known people, and I've done this myself, where you're on a one-person project and you can still use those, you know, the principles of Agile, because it's really rapid feedback, collaboration, communication, eliminating waste. So we always talk about YAGNI, right? You ain't going to need it. And this goes back to, I'll just tell a quick story. When I was in college, I was doing a co-op for a company, and this was a long time ago, and it was in a language that's long dead. But I had my manager came up to me and said, hey, they want to have a calculator in this app. It was an existing app that, how did he word it? He said, they need a calculator in here so they can add numbers easily. Well, I'm an engineer. I'm in engineering school. I heard calculator. So what did I do? I did what any good engineer would do. I recreated the TI-35, which is God's gift to calculators, in this application, right? Took me several weeks. And my boss kept coming by, are you done yet? Are you done yet? And I'm like, no, I'm still working on it, right? So finally, here's the big reveal, right? I get everybody gathered around, and I'm showing that I've got 1 over x and y to the x and, you know, square root and all these things in here. And my manager's, where's the add button? Where's the add button? Where's the add button? And I'm like, I'm getting there, right? Because to me, that was trivial, right? Add, I did that the first day, right? But I got all these other functions in here, right? I even put a log function in there. And not logging, but, you know, the arithmetic log. And it was just a classic case of the exact same sentence, whether it's said or read, can mean different things to completely different people. So even as an individual, right, if I was unclear, I should have gone back, or I should have, you know, written, now we call them user stories, but written down the requirement. And if I'm going to recreate a calculator, I'm going to put down all those things that I'm going to put in the calculator and go back before I write a line of code and go back to my boss and say, is this what you said? Because this is what I understand that you asked for.
But you started down the path of you ain't going to need it. And let me try that scenario on the calculator, because I can imagine that you're sitting there and you say, okay, I've got add. They're going to want subtract. I should just put subtract in now.
Oh, and as engineers, we want to do that. Right.
Exactly.
You know, someday they're going to ask for Y over X, so I better put it in there.
Exactly.
Right. And that's something that we really, and this isn't necessarily an agile topic, but we try and enforce it when we talk about these types of things, is as developers, we want to outthink the business. And we shouldn't do that because there might not be any value. If the customer doesn't need subtract, they don't want to pay for subtract. And so if we've got that rapid feedback loop where before I write all this stuff, and it took me several weeks to write this TI-35 emulator in SAS, you know, I could have gone back and had this thing working that very day and I would have been a star. They'd be like, oh my gosh, it's great. I give you something, you have it the same day or the next day, and let's give you more work. Instead, it was, boy, you didn't listen to me at all, right? And so that's the communication part. From a, you know, even a single, we're kind of down this path of single developer, because I always hear, well, I'm just a single developer. I can't do Agile. Even if we just talk about a card wall, and this is something, now there's a whole lot of flavors of Agile out there, right? Agile is kind of this all-encompassing thing. And Scrum is probably the most popular. I don't have numbers to back it up, but 80% of all statistics are made up anyway.
There you go. Right?
So, but Scrum is very, very popular, right? And Scrum really handles processes. XP came out about the same time, and XP handles a lot of the same things, talking about iterations and feedback and stand-ups, things like that, but also focuses on the software engineering side of it, things like TDD and pair programming and continuous integration and things like that. Something that we've adopted from manufacturing world, from lean manufacturing, is this idea of Kanban. And Kanban works differently than, you know, traditional iteration-based Agile. In iteration-based Agile, we are going to work for 2 weeks, 1 week, 4 weeks, you know, some length of time. Everything's time-boxed. And we're going to do as much as we can in this amount of time. And at the end of that period of time, we're like, okay, the goal is to have potentially releasable software. Now, it doesn't mean you release into production, but you release to a reviewer, things like that. Whereas with Kanban, you're not waiting for an arbitrary time limit, right? And when I say arbitrary, you know, you shouldn't be jogging sprints back and forth in your life. But if I get a feature done, the add feature on day one,
right,
I should give it to the user so they get immediate benefit from it, right? Not wait for all the other functions of the TI-35 to come to fruition and then give them the software in 4 weeks. So in Kanban, we're more talking about work and process limits. So you'll have, and this is probably the best route to go for a single developer in managing their workflow, because we always tend to take on more than we should as engineers, because we're supermen and women. We all know that we're engineers, right? Here's the big cape, big E on it. And so if I can say, I'm only going to have three things in flight at a time, right? Only three things working at a time. And that's my limit. That's my work in process limit. And I can't pick another thing up to start doing until I finish one of those. And literally, it started just as a card wall. And you just imagine moving cards across. So you have ready to be started, in progress, ready for test, you know, and the titles vary, right? But so a lot of people that I know that are independent developers are using more of a Kanban style, because it's like the customer, I can deliver something to the customer rapidly without waiting for a period of time. It's also a great way to do support, right? A lot of times I hear support organizations can't be agile because when a ticket comes in, they have to fix it, right? They can't wait 4 weeks to get this bug fix in there, or 2 weeks, or whatever your sprint length is. Well, Kanban is perfect for those organizations, because we want to do two things. We want to make sure that our support developers are focused and not context switching between 10 different things, because, you know, after all, we're single core processors, right? We don't have multiple cores. I can't have multiple things going on in my brain at the same time. So from a support arena, if I have 10 tickets and they're listed in priority, well, I can only work on one or two or three at a time. And as soon as I get those done, they get tested, they get deployed. So the customer is not waiting for this bug that's in production just because 4 weeks hasn't passed. So that's kind of the one developer scenario. Probably works better than so doing a stand-up, a daily stand-up as a single developer project is kind of silly, right? Because, you know, as you're looking in the mirror, and this is what I did yesterday, this is what I do today, and the man in the mirror is holding me back. But, you know, the typical team that we try and strive for is 6 to 8, you know, somewhere around there, 5 to 8. When you start getting into teams of 10 or more, But you really want to break those down so they're more focused, because communication becomes a problem, right? If I've got that many people, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen, as they say. And then you start breaking. What I always did as a coach is I would break those down into feature teams. So, you know, one of the projects that I worked on, we had 19 people on this project. And what we did was we divided it, and I was one of the 19, right? So I was only like a partial dev resource and then architecture and scrum master. We divided into typically what's referred to as a scrum of scrums. So we had three teams, and, you know, one was focused on front end, one was focused on services, and the other one was focused on, we had some BizTalk integration stuff going on. So they were really doing that heavy lifting on the back end with Commerce Server and BizTalk. And they would all work on their set of features, but a representative from each of those teams would then meet after their daily stand-up to have another daily stand-up to report back to team progress. So we still had that rapid feedback loop between the teams, but you didn't have 19 people standing in a circle saying, you know, yesterday I worked on the login screen, today I'm gonna work on, you know, the login validation and nothing's holding me back. You know, when the guy that's working on BizTalk is like, okay, that's interesting, but how does that affect me? But there could be things that are cross-cutting concerns. And so you still want to have that high bandwidth communication between the teams. So you can scale Agile, certainly, but you're going to scale it in small pieces. And you still have to make sure you've got that high bandwidth communication between all the pieces.
So for Kanban, you can do that on a whiteboard. You can do that with Post-its, and you can do that electronically.
Absolutely. So most people start with Post-its and things like that. And even with traditional Agile, you know, Scrum and XP, where you have what's called a burn down chart, which is their, you know, Scrum's version of the Kanban board, right? So the beauty of the Kanban board is twofold. First of all, as a developer, I know what I'm working on, I know what's coming, and I know where things are. The other beauty is transparency. So as a manager, as a stakeholder, as somebody who's not directly involved in development, I don't have to go around and ask every developer how they're doing. I can walk into the team area, look at the board, and go, yeah, we're making good progress, right? There was a bunch of stuff on the left side of the board, which is not started, and now there's a bunch of stuff on the right side of the board, which is complete. So I can very easily see. The way we handle that in Scrum, traditional Scrum, is what's called a burn down chart. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of the sprint, you have an X amount of work, and day zero, you have, let's say we have 40 units of work. And typically you use story points, but it can be hours, it can be whatever measurement you want to do, right? I'm not hung up on that. And at the end of the sprint, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, you should have zero work left. So you have this nice declining line on the grid, and you can walk into a team area, same thing, and if the line is going down, things are good. If the line is flat, there's a problem, right? What I like to do is use both, because the problem with a traditional burndown chart, if I've got a flat line, in other words, we're not reducing any amount of work over time, What's the problem?
Yeah, well, the chart's not showing you.
You don't know, right? I'm looking at that going, yeah, there's a problem. Now I have to start talking to people. Right. And talking to people interrupts them. Right. There's already a problem. Right. And now I'm going to interrupt everybody in the middle of what they're doing and say, hey, it's a problem. You, it's a problem. You, it's a problem. You, you know, how do I find this out? If you have both, then it's great, because when you use both, you have not started, in development, ready for QA, ready for integration, you know, whatever your things are. And if I look at the board and I see I've got 20 cards stacked up on ready for QA, what's the problem? We're short QA resources, right? Maybe that person is out sick, on vacation, you know, whatever the story is, it's very evident. So using both works very well. Most teams start with just whiteboards and cards, right? Because they're trying to just figure it out. The downside to that is if I have any sort of distributed team, right? If I'm working in a big company that's got multiple offices, then I'm still calling somebody, or we got to take pictures of it, or things like that. So electronic is very, very good for that purposes, because now I can have a distributed Kanban board, a distributed burndown chart, right? Where I see everybody's tasks, I see what's in flight, I see what's worked on, you know, and I can increase that, again, have high bandwidth communication between all members of the team. You know, I work for a company that I live in Cincinnati. the main U.S. office is in Boston, and world headquarters is in Sofia, Bulgaria, right? I work for Telerik. We are all over the world. We're in, I think, 9 countries now. It's hard for me to keep up. We keep opening offices. My team, so I work for, as the evangelist for Team Pulse, which is our agile project management software. The product owner is in Winnipeg. The executive vice president division is in Winnipeg, Canada. We've got myself in Cincinnati. We've got sales and engineering in Boston. We've got sales and engineering in Sofia. And I believe we have some QA resources. And I might be wrong on this, but we've got some QA resources in their country as well. I just don't remember what country it is right now. If we don't have some sort of electronic form of this, there's no way anybody knows what anybody's doing. There's two sides of the fence, and I am firmly straddling it. Because I'm not entirely sure which way I want to go. I used to always coach people to start with post-its and a whiteboard. Don't let a tool confuse the people, right? Because sometimes we get a little lost by the shiny penny, and we get hung up in the tool, and we kind of forget why we're doing it. The tools that you know, and even our tool does this, right? And our tool does it very well, is the advantage of having a tool is you get that knowledge base of some other people who have been there and done that who can guide you, right? So within Team Pulse, we have something called the Best Practices Analyzer. So as you're setting up your boards and working on your stories and things like that, it's like for developers who probably listen to this podcast, it's like FXCop, which is something that would help that Microsoft put out that would help you kind of do a code review of your .NET code. Right. So we've got the Best Practices Analyzer that says, hey, you have this story that's in progress, but you don't have any estimates around it. Right? That's kind of bad. How can you have something in your sprint, you know, which is the current amount of work that you're doing, where you don't have any estimates? You haven't matured it, or it's not prioritized correctly. So we have that built in, and that can really help people understand, you know, where they're kind of, I won't say dropping the ball because that has such a negative connotation, but anytime you're learning to do something differently, right, it's always great to have a guiding hand. Best bet, have an agile coach, somebody who's done transformation sitting there. Guess what? That's expensive, right? You're bringing in a consultant. You're probably paying their team, their travel and expenses as well as their time to do this because you need somebody who has that experience to be there. And then, you know, hopefully that person can help grow one of your own employees to take that role and then teach other teams. But in lieu of that, economy's tight, right? There's not a whole lot of slack in budgets these days. So in lieu of that, you need software that can guide you.
And what else will Team Pulse do besides providing that guidance?
Well, so we've took a very, very different approach than a lot of the software out there in that we find ideas very, very important. As a matter of fact, an idea is a first-class citizen for us. And, you know, we talked about that telephone game communication problem between, you know, if somebody comes up with an idea and then it gets handed off and handed off, handed off, and eventually the developer gets some words on a card that says, you know, make a TI-35, when the original request was create an add button, right? I want to add 2 integers. Well, with Team Pulse, we track those ideas in the system. So when an idea comes in, and you can, the idea and feedback portal can be made public, it can be made internal, like an extranet application, things like that, right? So for a consumer-facing application, you can have your customers submit ideas. For an intranet type of application, you can have, here's the sales guy saying, I need to be able to quickly add numbers when I'm in the field. I want an add button in this mobile app, right? So now this idea has been submitted. We can, as a team, internally comment and discuss this idea, right? So QA gets involved and can look at it and say, yeah, I can test that. If you put an add button in there, I know how to test that. But if you're going to do Y over X, it's harder to test. I'm not, you know, a QA person. I'm making stuff up, but for instance, you know, we can say we don't have the bandwidth. You know, if we add this add button, we're going to have to drop this other feature that we're planning to do in the next sprint. So that type of discussion can be had. And then when a decision's been made, you can then make a public comment back to the idea, right? And public being to the submitter, and not necessarily to the greater world, but maybe to your sales force if it's intranet, and say, yes, we can do it. It's going to take 3 sprints, you know, or it's on the backlog, or we need more definition, things like that, right? So the team has access to the idea. Let's say that idea gets approved. Everybody's like, yay, we're going to make this thing, right? An add button is a great idea. So that idea then gets linked to a story. And in Agile, again, we have to change terms so we can sell more books, right? So a story is a backlog item. The backlog is the requirements. So really, what to make a short story long, a story is a requirement, right? So I have this requirement, put an add button. And now that I have this story in Team Pulse, I can start adding tasks. I can start adding artifacts to it. We can comment and discuss the story. So if you've got human factors or design people, they can put a mock-up in there, right, and attach it to the story. So as a developer, I can go see the mock-up in one place of what it's supposed to look like. QA, again, can add in acceptance criteria. Here's how we know it works, right? Here's the acceptance criteria. Developers can add tasks. Well, I have to make sure I have the add function. I have to hook the add function up to the add button. Again, this is a trivial example. And it can be more complicated than that. But now we have tasks for developers, we have acceptance criteria for the quality engineers, and throughout this whole thing, as a developer, right, if I'm a line developer, maybe I'm new, intern, whatever, and I get assigned a task, right, as part of this greater story, I look at the task and I go, I need to put a button on a form. I really don't understand why, but in Team Pulse, since we have captured that entire thought process electronically, the developer can go, well, I don't understand why, but here's the story it's attached to. Oh, here's the original idea. Oh, here's the discussion that we had about this idea. They get all of that context, and it's not somebody writing a 200-page requirements document for an add function. It's normal conversations you're going to have anyway, but we're capturing them.
Right.
So now as a developer, I can know the spirit in addition to the words, and I'm going to make a better product. You know, a better example than just an add button is something more significant, right? Let's say we need a mobile app so we can place orders when we're in the field. And that's the type of idea you're going to get from somebody, not just an add button. And so that would not just become one requirement, but it would become like an epic or a saga. And in an epic or a saga, you know, as the name implies, multiple stories, right? And some people even have a hierarchy. Sagas are bigger than, or epics are bigger than sagas. So an epic can have multiple sagas. Sagas have multiple stories. That's just an implementation detail that you know, team culture dictates. But now, so I have this really big requirement, which is create a whole new app that has to tie into purchasing, has to tie into inventory and all these things. And as a developer gets a task, which might be pull, you know, sometimes we get this type of requirement, and developers will understand this. Use OData to get the current inventory.
Right.
Which is like, okay, so if that's my requirement, and I'm a junior developer, you know, or a new developer, or new to the company, I'm not rocking a boat. I'm going to use OData to get the current inventory. But if that developer had the entire context handy, where the developer could say, we've got other ways to get data. What am I trying to accomplish? And instead of trying to hunt down five or six different people, again, a developer looks through the entire ideation chain and says, oh, we're really trying to feed this data into a mobile app. Let's not use OData. We already have hooks into the web API that we plugged into this MVC app or whatever. And we already have stuff there. So I don't even have to write this OData layer. I can just hook into our existing thing. So now we're making better software the first time, and we're empowering developers to have that context so they can make the right decisions.
Right, and that begs the question then on Team Pulse specifically of what size team are you seeing as the smallest team that's getting advantage out of having that automation?
So we've got a lot of people who are single users out there. Mm-hmm. Now the average that we're seeing is 10 person teams, right? 7 to 10. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, we've got a lot of, you know, we've got some very, very, very big customers down to very small customers. And the big customers, you know, the 100, 150 licenses or seats of Team Pulse, they're still using 10 person teams. Because within Team Pulse, you can have multiple projects. You can have, you know, number of people assigned to a project. You can have people assigned to multiple projects. Now, traditional agilists just cringed all over the world because I just said people are assigned to multiple projects. Guess what? That's reality, right? And we understand that that's reality because you might be 20% support, 20% for this project that you rolled off of, but you're the only one who has domain knowledge, mm-hmm. right? And 60% on this new thing. So it's something that you can use individually. As a matter of fact, right now we've got a promotion going that if you have the Ultimate Collection, you get a single seat of Team Pulse as well. So you can use it by yourself, right? It's nice to have that electronic thing. I use it on my laptop for my work. When I'm doing talks or preparing new talks or I have to book travel, I use Team Pulse to manage my day-to-day. And there's a couple reasons for that. It's a little heavy for non-development, but I'm dog-fooding it, right? I want to use Team Pulse so I can come back and say, hey, you know what? This workflow could be better if such and such. We have a fairly large team that's divided up in a couple different functional areas, and we're using Team Pulse ourselves. Matter of fact, we're using every 2 weeks, we're doing 2 week iterations, and we constantly are updating our instance, and it's called dog food, imagine that, of Team Pulse with the latest build. So we're using continuous integration to continually update what we're using for our own development, and we being the development team, because I want to be clear, very, very smart people working on development, I'm an evangelist, right? They don't want me writing code on the product itself. But so they're constantly using it, right? So, and again, this is that rapid feedback loop. If I have to use something that I just wrote, I'm going to find bugs. Because as a developer, when we test things, we always test the way we expect a user to use something, right? Then we give it to the user, and what do? They do the exact opposite of what we expect. And when we use our own software, we're going to find those types of things, right? So you can have as many people assigned to a project as you want in Team Pulse, you know, as many seats as you have. But to answer your original question, and to make a short story very long, we're finding the average team size per project is about 10.
Let me take you in a very different direction, which is I'm listening to this show. I get fired up about Agile, and I'm going to say again, because I think there are a lot of folks out there who've been fired up about Agile once, twice, five times in the past, and they go out, and it's just overwhelming to get started. Do you see a path that the aspiring Agile developer can follow in order to pick his way through the various schools of agility, if you'll forgive me, and find how to get started using Agile in this project?
Yeah, so the big thing that I always tell people, and I'm going to make a point of saying it, you know, after I do this whole day Agile pre-con, is don't walk into your company the next day. Let's say you read a book on Agile, right? You go over the weekend, you read this book, and you're all fired up again, because it's kind of, like you said, might be the seventh or eighth time you've gotten fired up about it. And walk into your boss and say, guess what? Everything that we're doing is wrong. We have to throw it all out the window, and we have to do it this new way. That doesn't work, right? They'll probably get you fired or severely reprimanded. Because obviously the company wouldn't be in business if nothing worked. What we're talking about with Agile is reducing waste, increasing communication and collaboration, right? Improving software quality. So how can I do that as an individual developer? Take small steps, figure things out from a developer standpoint. And I'm an engineer, that's my background, right? So I was a consultant for 20 some years before I joined Telerik. Understand test-driven development. Understand behavior-driven development. Start writing unit tests around your code. Make sure that you're writing good code the first time. Understand things like pair programming. Now, pair programming is one of those things where you always get pushback, right? I'm not having two people do the same job. Well, we pair program anyways, developers. Everybody who's listening to this podcast at some point in their development career has called somebody over to their computer to say, can you look at this code? Because I can't figure out why it can't work. Guess what that is? That's paraprogramming. So, you know, learn those types of development software engineering techniques, first and foremost, right? And Kent Beck's original book on extreme programming, I call the original book like the second edition, and I'm sure you'll put the link up in your show notes. It's a great resource for that, right? There's a lot of information out there on test-driven development and behavior-driven development. My blog, schematic.com, is my blog address. I've got a lot of stuff out there for that, and that's ski as in snow skiing, medic as in paramedic, not schematic like a database design. So there's get your house in order. It's a lot easier to go to somebody else and suggest they try something new if you've been doing it for a while and having positive results. And more often than not, and I would do this at companies, right? I would go in and they're like, we're not going to be agile, right? So don't even mention the word agile. But I'll go in, and I'm a test-driven development guy, right? I don't I feel dirty if I write code that doesn't have a test. Does that mean that I always write tests before I write code? No, there are times where shipping's a feature and I'm gonna write code because I'm in a hurry and I don't always have good code coverage. But then I take a really long shower after that and I make sure I fix it, right? Because I feel dirty when I do it. But you have to be pragmatic, and shipping's a feature. But if I'm sitting there working in an organization, and I've done this before, and QA's, you know, quality engineering is doing their thing, and they come back with 40 bugs, and you have one or two, and your other developers all have 10, they're going to start looking at you and go, well, why does Phil get to leave on time, and I have to stay? And the manager says, well, Phil doesn't have any bugs. Or he's already cleaned up his bug queue, and he's done. You know, you guys have to stay until you get this done. You know, the traditional, you work until it's right, and you know, midnight madness and everything else. And then all of a sudden, the next day, they come to your cube and say, what are you doing that's getting you out of here at 5 o'clock and making it to happy hour, and we're missing dinner and missing our daughter's soccer practice, right? And, well, you know, I write these tests. Let me show you how. So lead by example. If you bring success to the table, it's going to spread, right? The other thing I would always do is I'd make my own little Kanban board, just my own little one. And even if I didn't have a whiteboard in my cube, I'd find a way, you know, thumbtacks or whatever. Well, don't do thumbtacks in drywall. Companies get mad at that. But a lot of times you've got those cube walls where you can stick those push pins in. And I would just get some index cards and write what I was working on and just make a little Kanban board for me. Just for me, nobody else. And I wasn't trying to get other people to do it. But then when the project manager comes by, and we all know this story, right? So the project manager, and this is not a knock against project managers because they're just trying to do their job. But they'd come around every morning, and I've had this happen on multiple projects in the past, and they've got their, you know, Microsoft project open. And they're like, okay, Phil, what percentage done are you on this task? Well, the task, in my mind, is either done or not done. It's either raining or it's not raining, right? And so to try and assign a percentage to it, it's a made-up number anyway. So I'd always say something like 73%. Because if you say an odd number like that, they think it's scientific. Oh, he must be making, you know, he must really be 73% done. Because if I said 75%, they're like, well, you just made it up. So now the project manager goes around, and I've done this in companies in the past, and they're looking at, you know, they got their laptop open or their little printout, and they're asking everybody how done they are. And they get to my cube, and they look at the wall, and they go, oh, okay. And they move on. Because they can see exactly how done I am. Because all my tasks that I've been assigned to start on the left of the wall, and if they're in the done column, then they're done. So things like that, you know, like I said, get your own house in order before you accuse other people of having a messy home. And when you do those types of things yourself and get those types of good practices in play, then companies or team members are more likely to listen.
You mentioned more than once TDD and BDD.
Yes.
I think I have a fair understanding of test-driven development, and we've had some folks on talking about test-driven development. Can you talk about behavior-driven development?
Certainly. So test-driven development is, the problem with test-driven development is it has the name test, right? So everybody always thinks that test-driven development is about tests, and the only reason that you do it is to have tests in place. Tests are really a benefit. It's a side effect, but they're a benefit of doing test-driven development because you're really driving the design or the development through tests because that's really the only way in static languages like C#, Java, those types of things that we have of doing it. Behavior-driven development came about, and there's actually two different people who kind of came up with the term. Dan North documented it in I can't recall where the blog post is, but I can get it to you so you can put it in your show notes. But he first documented what he called behavior-driven development, because he was tired of having to say, no, this isn't about testing, right? This isn't a QA thing. This is making cleaner design, faster design, that type of stuff. At the exact same time, Scott Belwer wrote an article for Code Magazine talking about behavior-driven development. And they had a little different way of doing it. But what we're trying to do with behavior-driven development, and I'll give you the link for Scott Belwer's article as well, we're trying to look at the bigger picture. And it's more of an outside-in approach. TDD, or test-driven development, we're testing individual Lego blocks, because everybody understands Legos, because Legos are cool, right? And the theory is, if I have all these separate Lego blocks, and they all work, when I put them together, the whole is going to work. right? It's going to do exactly what I want it to. I took this picture when I was in Legoland. They had some water ride, and they had a submarine, right? With the guy in the submarine, the hatch was open, and there was a guy from the waist up, typical Lego character, like, because everything's made out of Legos, and he was outside the hatch looking through the periscope. Mm-hmm. He was outside the hatch looking through the periscope, right? I'm sure that the unit test for the periscope worked. I'm sure the unit test for the hatch worked. I'm sure the unit test for the captain of the submarine worked. But when they put the pieces together, the periscope was outside the hatch. So for this particular submarine, for somebody to use the periscope, they had to open the hatch. Well, if you open the hatch, and the reason you use a periscope is you don't have to surface. So if you open the hatch to use the periscope, the sub sinks. Then you have to surface. Well, if you're surface, you don't need the periscope. And that, to me, that just epitomizes why we need things like behavior-driven development. Because I need to make sure from an outside-in approach that these things work, right? So I have my behavior. I need to be able to see what's on the surface while the submarine is submerged. So when, and this is, so I prefer what became known as context specification style of BDD, which is Scott Belware, what he put forth, because I think it's a cleaner syntax. But very many, you know, there's a whole lot of people that are happy with Dan North's style, which is as an X, I want to Y for benefit of Z, right? As a submarine captain, I want to be able to see what's on the surface while submerged so that I don't, you know, surface next to an enemy ship. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I'm kind of making that up. And then you have success criteria. Given 30 feet of water, it's given when then. So given 30 feet of water, when raising the periscope, then I should be able to see what's on the surface. And that works for a whole lot of people. And in the .NET world, you have things like SpecFlow that will take those, that gherkin, as it's called, and convert it into a unit test. I prefer, just because it's my own personal preference, Scott Bell, what Scott Belware brought forth, and it's called context specification. And it's when submerged at a depth of 30 feet, it should allow me to see what's on the surface. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I can write that test and not implement the code because I don't have a periscope. I don't even have a submarine at this point. I have a behavior that my final product has to pass. Right? Now, to get to that behavior, I have to build a periscope. I have to build a hatch. I have to build a submarine.
And when you do each of those sub pieces, are you then doing unit tests against them, or are you doing
So I use a product called, it's an open source thing called MSpec, mm-hmm. originally written by Aaron Jensen, and I can't recall the gentleman who's taken it over, but I'll give you the link for MSpec for the show notes. So in C#, the way MSpec works is the name of the class, you name it, when at a depth of 30 feet, that's the name of your class. And then you have an arrange and an action in there. But then it uses delegates for the it keyword. So it is actually a test, right? So you have this it type, because everybody looks at MSpec the first time and go, there's no it in .NET. No, it's a delegate from the framework. It should allow me to see what's on the surface. Mm-hmm. And that becomes my specification or my assertion. So I have multiple of those. It should not let water in while looking on the surface. It should, you know, have a magnification of 10x, those types of things. And those are tests. And when you use a test runner, like Just Code's test runner, there's also a Galio works with it, and lots of other things work with it as well. Then it looks at the it, every it keyword or variable type, and it, well, it's a delegate, but whatever. It executes those as tests. Now, when I'm doing this outside in development, I don't have any code for that because I don't even have a periscope. So now I make another test. When looking through the periscope, it should allow magnification of up to 10x. It should have 360-degree turn radius. Mm-hmm. And so I keep building these specifications until I get to the Lego block. Now I have a Lego block, which is the focus knob on the periscope. And, you know, sometimes I'll drop into using an N unit or an MB unit at that level to write a pure unit test. But the advantage with this outside-in development paradigm is twofold. First of all, to get to that focus knob in a traditional TDD style, I still had to think through all those scenarios. In my mind, unlike Periscope, 10X, oh, I have to focus, right? So now I build this Lego block.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole thought process to get down to that unit test isn't captured anywhere but in my brain. With BDD, now I've captured all of that thought process. So if I get hit by a bus, and we all know that in IT, the proverbial bus is a higher paying job across the street, right?
Right.
That developer leaves, all that work's not wasted because it's captured. And now I build the focus knob, I build the lens, I build the individual Lego blocks. I still have these tests in place to make sure that when I put these things together, the periscope is usable when the hatch is closed.
Right. That's great.
And that's the beauty of, you know, I'm making sure not just the pieces, but the behavior of the application is doing what's expected.